We're going to start our discussion of conflict resolution for Christians. And the way that I've organized this is I started with the passages that I'm sure deal with conflict resolution, and we continue. This is good. It's going to be a long discussion. We're going to talk about all of the different kinds of conflict that arise and the ways that we can deal with that conflict. But this morning, we're going to start in Matthew, the 18th chapter. And in verse 15, beginning, Jesus has this to say. It seems as if, to me, this is kind of a self-contained discussion. It doesn't seem like this is Jesus responding to a particular situation, but it seems like this is a general statement that Jesus chooses to make. I will mention that Matthew is the only one of the Gospels that includes this statement. That's a little surprising to me, given the fact that Matthew is written a little bit later than some of the other books. But this is what Jesus says in Matthew 18, beginning at verse 15. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you've gained your brother. If he does not listen, take one or two others along with you, that every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. If he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. So the first thing I think we ought to do is look at some parallel, but not really parallel passages, some related passages. And I'll give you an opportunity to add those passages that you think, as you have reflected on this, that you think can help us to understand it. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the specific parts of what Jesus said. So Lenny's going to conclude this next week. Kim and I are going to be in Southern California for my grandson Maddox's graduation. So Lenny will continue this next week, and he's going to use the outline that I provided for him. So let's look at these passages and just sort of keep them in mind as we try to understand Matthew 18. Somebody want to read Leviticus, the 6th chapter, verses 2 through 7? Now, I know this is Old Testament. This is Old Covenant. So there's some question in my mind whether I ought to take everything that's in Leviticus and apply it to our situation today, because we live under a different covenant. But I think there's something that we can learn here, and seems to be some general principle. Yeah.
You want me to read Leviticus 6?
Yes, go ahead.
You got it. I'm reading from the New King James as well. If a person sins and commits a trespass against the Lord by lying to his neighbor about what was delivered to him for safekeeping, or about a pledge, or about a robbery, or if he has extorted from his neighbor, or if he has found what was lost and lies concerning it and swears falsely, in any one of these things that a man may do in which he sins, then it shall be because he has sinned and is guilty, and he shall restore what he has stolen, or the thing which he has extorted, or what was delivered for him for safekeeping, or the lost thing which he found, or all about which he has sworn falsely, he shall restore its full value and one-fifth more of it, or to it, and give it to whomever it belongs on the day of his trespass. And he shall bring to his trespass offering to the Lord a ram without blemish, from the flock with your valuation as a trespass offering to the priest, so the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord, and he shall be forgiven of any one of these things that he may have done in which he trespasses.
Okay. There are, in my mind, there are two important things here. These tend to be property crimes. Okay. And the Old Testament, of course, because it was a theocratic kind of covenant, the Old Testament included property crimes because that the Old Testament was not only a religious law, but it was civil law. That's the way that those people who lived under the Old Covenant interpreted their law. Okay? We don't do that today. We have a distinction between civil law and what we would call religious law. And that distinction, even though in our day, that most of civil law is based on religious law, it's not exactly the same. In the Old Covenant, it was exactly the same. Okay? So most of these are property crimes. That it seems to be an important idea. Number one, it's important because he says, you've trespassed against the Lord. When you commit a property crime, you trespass against the Lord. Now, you've also trespassed against your neighbor. You've harmed your neighbor in one way or another. Other thoughts? Anybody else?
Restitution's required.
Yeah, restitution. It was a legitimate idea that you would restore or make your neighbor whole, okay? And you would add a fifth. So you would add 20%. So, again, I'm not suggesting that that's the way that it has to be done, but you know, most of us have been harmed in one way or another. You're driving down the road, somebody runs into you. Your insurance is supposed to make you whole, but it doesn't. They give you fair market value for your car. And, you know, if somebody ran into my Mazda because it has 200,000 miles on it, fair market value would be like $500. Well, it's worth a lot more than that to me. So this idea of restoring or making whole, that's an important concept. I would also mention that in the English Standard Version, the time when a person makes restitution is in verse 5. It says, he makes this restitution to whom it belongs on the day he realizes his guilt. I like that reading because it in my mind it reinforces the idea that you realize your guilt and you make restitution. Okay. Yeah.
Although these are property crimes, it's the sin of lying and being dishonest and coveting other people's properties that is the real
well, that's
problem.
True. That's true. These are property crimes, but they involve a basic dishonesty. You're right. In the Old Testament, and maybe even today, it's hard to distinguish between property crimes and crimes against God, which we call sin. Okay? Some sin does not involve property crimes. Some property crimes are, or all property crimes are sin. But you can't make a one-to-one correspondence there. And I'm really impressed with what David said after he had been confronted by Nathan and told about his adultery with Bathsheba, he said, against God he had sinned. And so, you know, even though it was clearly a sin committed against Bathsheba, it was also sin committed against God. Yeah, Tim.
And that doesn't seem to be separate here, because in addition to making restitution with your fellow man, with your neighbor that you have defrauded in some way, you make a guilt offering to God. So
that's
in,
right.
In verse 6, it says, as a penalty, he must bring to the priest, that is, to the Lord, his guilt offering. And it's very specific about what kind of a guilt offering that would be.
Yes.
So it doesn't separate the fact that the defrauding and being dishonest with your neighbor, with another human being, doesn't separate that from sin against God.
Yes, yes. That's true. Okay, let's look at 1 Thessalonians 4 at verse 6. Somebody want to read that one?
And that in this manner, no one should wrong or take advantage of a brother or sister. The Lord will punish all those who commit such sins, as we have told you and warned you before.
Okay, now here again, this is a sin that's committed against a brother or sister has been harmed. And that's what he's talking about here. Don't do that. Do not harm brother or sister. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 8. First Corinthians 8, beginning at verse 10. Somebody want to read that and read down through the end of that paragraph at verse 13?
Or if someone with a weak conscience sees you, with all your knowledge, eating in an idol's temple, won't that person be emboldened to eat what is sacrificed to idols? So this weak brother or sister through whom Christ dies is destroyed by your knowing, by your knowledge, when you sin against them in this way, and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if what I eat causes my brother or sister to fall into sin, I will never eat it again, so that I will not cause them to fall.
Okay. What I want you to see in this passage is that the problem is that you have harmed your brother. You have caused him to sin. Okay? If he doesn't like it, just because he doesn't like it, that's not under consideration here. You caused him to sin. Now, sometimes people who disagree with you are not going to do what you have done. You have not emboldened their conscience. Okay? In that case, 1 Corinthians 8 does not apply to you. Make sense? Floyd Thompson used to say there's a big difference between offending a brother and causing a brother to offend. Some people don't like it that I eat meat. Okay? And, you know, there's, you know what vegetarian means, really bad hunter. So I eat meat. Some people are offended by that, but they're not going to eat meat. I'm not causing them to do something that they think is unbiblical. They may not like it, but I'm not causing them to offend. So I'm not harming a brother who is not caused to offend. Any other passages that you see that kind of bear on this same idea? And this is the way that we'll proceed. I'll give you the passages that I think bear on it, and in your reflection, also supply other passages that you think bear on it. So this is your chance to bring up other passages that might bear on this. Yeah, go ahead.
Could Job be an example of some of these things? I found Job 2:10.
Okay, can you read that?
Well, I mean, it kind of starts at 7. The Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Jacob with sore boils. And then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." And he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." So could that be connected to the one about don't let your friend, like the 1 Corinthians 8:10-13, about I took it as leading your friends into like doing not so good things. And he kind of was telling her, don't try to tell me that I should curse God for doing this. God is the person who I trust and he's doing this. And like you said, we shall accept good from God and then we can't accept adversity. So I didn't know if that was like connected kind of conflict resolution sort of between him and his wife a little about don't try to lead me away.
Yeah, I would connect it perhaps to a different discussion, not this discussion in particular, but yeah, she was trying to harm him. He was not harmed, but I think what she was suggesting would have been harm, but he was not harmed. Mary Wells, okay, that's the point of this, Bob.
Yeah, in 1 Corinthians 6, we have an example of a brother taking his brother to court before an unbelieving judge. And the recommendation there is to, why not rather be wrong? Why not rather be defrauded?
Okay. 1 Corinthians 6 is one of those passages that we're going to discuss it a little bit later in this discussion. We'll have a more in-depth discussion of 1 Corinthians 6, but yes, then that specifically is seeking remedy in the courts. And we will talk about that. Yeah. Yeah. Somebody else had their hand. Yeah, go ahead, Faye.
Matthew 5:23-24. Tells us not to wait around. We know that a brother has something against us to take care of it immediately.
You want to go ahead and read that?
Therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go first be reconciled to your brother, then come and present your offering.
Yeah, and that's an interesting passage because in Matthew 5, he shifts the responsibility for action to the person who has committed the wrong. In Matthew 18, the responsibility for action is the person who has been, is given to the person who has been wrong. So that's an interesting comparison between the two. Yeah, Carol?
The discussion about Job makes me think about the fact that in Job, God went to God first before he resolved, as he resolved the problem. It was God's answer, not, it would be like us going to God in prayer, but he went to God to the base. He says, this is God. God gives you good. Why not accept the other? He's focusing on God rather than on the problem. That's what it made me think of.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't include Job in this discussion, but clearly the book of Job presents a conflict that in Job, in the latter part of Job, is between Job and God and Job and his friends. I didn't include Job. So that's something for me to think about. And we can include that later in our discussion. Somebody else had their hand up, and I didn't see who it was. Okay. Well, let's talk about the passage. And let's talk about the constituent parts of this passage. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you have gained your brother. So, we'll start with that. The facts of the case, the facts of the conflict are, this is conflict with a brother. Okay? Then if your conflict is with someone who is not a Christian, then it's improper to use this passage to talk about how to resolve. We're talking about a brother or a sister. Okay. So we're talking about a Christian. If your brother sins against you, so you are the aggrieved party. It's a sin, and you are the aggrieved party. Okay? I have seen a lot of situations where somebody felt like they were the aggrieved party because they didn't clearly specify what was going to be the outcome of an interaction. It's like you're gonna do something for someone and they think you're gonna do more than what you really can do or promise to do. Okay, that's not sin. They're disappointed in what you did, but that's not sin. And there's a sense in which we benefit from clearly outlining what our expectations are when we have an interaction with someone. Okay. I had someone do some work on my property. I had some expectations about what was going to happen. Turned out that the situation wasn't really up to what my expectations were, but we'd never really talked about my expectations. It was just kind of, I thought that was going to happen. To this man's credit, this was a Christian. To his credit, he went way over and above what was required. Okay? And he kind of accepted my expectations and came back and did part of the job over again to meet my expectations. That was him going above and beyond what was actually required. That's a great credit to him. It's a great credit to anyone who does that, who goes over and above what was actually required. Okay. Would we say that one of the parties to this conflict is the aggrieved party? That's a person who's been harmed. Okay. the aggrieved party is harmed, and that doesn't diminish the sense in which God is involved in all of this. God is involved. Okay? So, it's a sin against you. If there's no sin against you, if you have not been harmed, this passage is not talking about the situation. And we sometimes take this passage and interpret it way too broadly and say, this covers every situation. It doesn't. It doesn't. It's a situation where someone has been harmed. So let's be careful and understand exactly what the passage says. A brother sins against you. You have been harmed. Then you go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. Hopefully you will gain your brother. So let's talk a little bit about the resolution at step one. Go and tell him his fault. Okay? Don't just rush to the end and say, I'm not going to have anything to do with him. I have to tell you, this is the temptation for me. When you wrong me, my temptation is to just cut you off. I just have nothing to do with you. That is a clear violation of this passage. That just clearly violates what God is telling us here. To say, I will consider him a Gentile and a tax collector without going and telling him his fault, that's nothing more than passive-aggressive conflict avoidance. And God will not tolerate that. It's between you and him alone. This is before you speak to anyone else for any reason. And if you're approached by an aggrieved party who has not taken this step, and you're not involved in the situation, don't listen. At all. Okay? Now again, remember, we're talking about the aggrieved party. If you are approached by someone who considers themselves to be the aggrieved party, and they have not taken this step, they have not gone and talked to that individual who they think has harmed them, don't listen. Don't have anything to do with it. Turn your back and walk away. And that's the root of most of the problems. People start trying to recruit people to be on their side. So they go and they recruit. That's nothing more than gossip. It is prohibited. And if they listen to you, you've gained your brother. Now, I have to tell you, there's something to be aware of in this situation. When someone comes to you and says, you have harmed me, don't rush to the conclusion that you called me a liar. And I can illustrate that. When I was working for Saddleback College, my boss was fired for incompetence. They hired somebody new. I applied for the job, didn't get it, but they hired somebody new. That person that they hired wore the kind of sunglasses that I now wear. Okay, those black sunglasses, they're called Wayfarers. They're made by Ray-Ban. Except mine have prescription lenses. Okay, that person came into the office, lost her wayfarers, and lost them at the same time that I got my prescription lenses in my wayfarers because I thought her glasses were cool. She accused me of stealing her wayfarers. Okay? And I said, wait, I didn't steal them. I just admired them. I told you I admired them. Here's the receipt. Now, I have to guard my heart against saying, my boss just accused me of theft. Okay, so it's just something to think about. Next week, we'll start up with resolution step two, and Lenny will continue the discussion next week. If there's anything that you think of that you could profitably add to the discussion, by all means, let Lenny know. You don't have the rest of the discussion next week.